this morning, trying an experiment of wrapping a bunch of things together, but I guess it's usually pretty easy in Zen to do that, make the connection to everything. Last Friday, I was went with a bunch of other folks, a lot of them government people, to the preparations for a watershed summit that's going to be held in a year. And a watershed is a geographical area that's defined by where a water drop falls and what stream it flows into, what river it flows into. And so it's usually marked by the ridge in an area. And we're near the headwaters of Peters Creek. It's about 1,000 feet or so upstream of us, where you pass it as you leave Jokoji heading towards the gap. There's a clearing and you can look down, and that's pretty much the headwaters of Peters Creek, and we have the pond here. And our Peters Creek flows downstream and helps to nurture an old apple orchard that I think our pond helped bring water to. And that creek helps to replenish the groundwater supply in this area. And then Peters Creek dives off the rocks, and in a high water flow time, there's apparently like a 200-foot waterfall where it drops down into the Portola Redwoods State Park area, and it joins Pescadero Creek and ends up in the ocean. Most of these other people that were part of this group were part of other watersheds like Arroyo and Coyote watersheds, which are in the South Bay and West Bay area. And what I want to relate it to is money. So where's the money? And what is it? And how are we affected by it? That's what I want to look at. I know volumes and volumes of, not in Buddhism necessarily, but elsewhere, are written about money and how to get rich and everything. And I wanted to look at how money makes us feel and how it comes to us and where it goes. And we have the Federal Reserve, and I think its purpose, someone may correct me if you'd like, that is...
I would like to know what we need the money for. I mean, you mentioned we're part of the watershed. Do we need money because we're part of the watershed? Or why is there money involved?
I wanted to look at money as far as like water, and how it flows into different places, how it comes from a source, and then it goes to a source. It goes to a Safeway, a Trader Joe's, and so it's going into a bigger stream, and they pay their suppliers, which feeds the bigger stream, and then it goes into the big pool of money that the Federal Reserve manages, controls. They set the interest rates.
Federal Reserve also... Though they don't actually print, that's done by the Treasury Department, but essentially on their orders, certain amount of money will be in circulation. So you have booms and you have recessions. When you have recessions, they withdraw them.
Right.
Certain money from it. When you don't have as much money circulating, you have bad business. So you're in charge completely of that.
But money is if you're controlling money, in a way you're controlling water. Like water, it's a supply, and it's not a static thing. It's not something that just stays put. It's in motion. And when it's in motion, we have all sorts of feelings about it. And as a businessman, when I was for about 11 years, I would get a job. And I'd get some startup money for starting the job. And I'd get my guys to get to work on the job. And I'd pay them. But the money wasn't mine. It came from the client. It went to them. And I had to pay them on Friday. It was like, pay them. That was a prime objective, to pay them. And not only to pay them, but I was to collect their payroll taxes and their Social Security taxes, and I had to pay the IRS, but was I paying the IRS, or were they paying the IRS, or was the client paying the IRS, and where was that money coming from? And if I had paid my guys and paid my suppliers, which is another source of where the money goes and comes, and I didn't have any money left in my bank account, what did I do? Did I find another job? There was all sorts of anxiety around money. And each of us, as I'm sure, felt it from time to time. How are we going to make the rent? What are we going to eat? And so I wanted to look at money in that way. And also in terms of how we get trapped in our notions about it. One of the fundamentals that Buddha talked about was the 12 causal links of dependent origination, like birth, becoming, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the coming together of subject and object, the six sense medias, the name and form, consciousness, the fabrications or the how things generate together and form new facets, ignorance, and then death. But it seems like money is deals a lot with clinging and craving. The second precept deals with no stealing. And this is how Eiken Roshi wrote about it. Buddha Dharma said, "Self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the unattainable Dharma, not having thoughts of gaining is called the precept of not stealing." Koban, one way he talked about, Koban Chino Roshi, one way he talked about, defined the second precept was, "Self-nature is mysteriously profound. Unattainable Dharma. Not to raise mind of attainable is called no stealing or robbing." So what is attainable? What is unattainable? What is another way to look at this? And I thought another way to is not to to receive what is offered, to receive what is freely given. Is not robbing, not stealing. And so even in a gesture of exchange, where you're receiving something from someone, a gift even, and how do you receive that gift is worth examining. What is it we feel? Where are we when we receive that gift. Money can be loved, it can be hated, it can be used and abused. One can be generous or stingy with money. So how do we judge these conditions of around that process of receiving and exchanging money? For example, I meant to have a bill to hand somebody, and you can offer it, and then you can kind of hold on to it slightly as that person is taking it, like, you know, how freely is it given? So pass it around and then I'll get back to Robert. Thank you. So the process of dealing with money, I mean, it happens to us over and over and over again. And how do we modulate it? How do we modify it? When I was a young kid, I remember, you know, finally getting old enough where I could run. I had this body, and it was like, you run with another friend and you're running as hard and as fast as you can to the end of the lot or the end of the block or to the edge of the lake, and you dive in, and then your heart's going, you can feel your heart in your throat, you can feel your lungs going, how just intense it is. And it's and how, like right now at my age, I don't do that anymore. So I've kind of used up that juice of energy. And you've all probably noticed dogs near where you live. A car is driving by, and a dog that's free will go chasing the tire. It'll be just chasing and chasing and chasing the tire, just. And if the car is going faster and faster, and finally he's just out of breath, and he turns around, and you've probably seen a dog turn around and just trot back, and it's going, you know, just out of breath and just not pleased with itself. Maybe, but usually not, because it didn't get anything. And it just kind of trots back to its spot where it likes to rest, and it sees its spot and it circles his resting spot, and then he sits down and puts his head on his paw. And you wonder about a dog, how many times he's done it. Has he done it like 10 times or 100 times or 1,000 times? And is he, you know, or does it take like the 1,001st time for him to say, I'm not going after that tire again? So I was wondering about greed and how that's used up. Or is it ever used up? And one of our Sangha members, he was telling me, he said he's known a lot of people, and everyone could use just a little more money. And so when is our bank account half full, or is it half empty? Mm-hmm. Or even if it is full, could we use a little bit more? And if that was there, what would be our limit of what we would want? Would it be another dollar, or would we say, that's enough? That's enough. I'm full. I mean, with a drink of water, you can drink and drink and drink and drink till your body's hydrated, and then you can drink and drink and drink and drink and drown. So it can be a poison. And I suppose money can be that way too. Those that no one drowns in money. You never hear of anyone dying because of excess money like that. You hear about some pretty weird offshoots that people take when they have lots of it. But I wonder with them, where does greed get modulated, modified, worn down? Where are the edges of our clinging, and this is a question I'm wondering if anybody might help me here. How is greed dealt with? Is it like, I will not be greedy? Is it because you read it in a book that it says greed is bad? It's one of the seven deadly sins. I refuse to be greedy. Is that when it happens, when an idea comes like that? Or is greed... how is greed modulated, modified?
By gratitude.
Yeah, I was going to say, when people stumble upon circumstance where they are giving to someone because they can, and that person really needs it, whatever kind, because it would be a very general situation, and then that makes them feel better. And if they make that connection, aha, me giving and getting nothing back but helping someone has made me feel better, because sort of their sense of identity has expanded from just them further out to another person or another group or as many people. Maybe they're helping feed a lot of people who have no food at all in some country, somewhere in this country. And that's one way. If they notice that, they may say, I think I'll follow this. That's one way. Another way might be, typically for people like me, was I got pretty tired of spending so much of my time and energy just producing money, because it was obvious that's what it was, because I was getting absolutely nothing out of the job. There was no requirement for high quality work. You just had to show up, punch a clock, and sit there and do your work for 8 hours and go home. And as long as you didn't break anything, great. And so there was no, other than financially, there was no reward at all. And I got to feeling, since I didn't get anything out of it except money, I said, I want to spend the less of my time and energy involved in this cycle of really sort of throwing away my life, making money. There's another way, so I could do something and make a lot more money, which I sort of gradually moved towards, but which isn't really a lot nowadays. That's another way. Someone will become aware of that. But it's about clinging and fear and insecurity. Mm-hmm. But also the people who are really, really make a lot of money, it's sort of a very strong habit from many lifetimes to really focus on that. Those are the people that look at their receipt really closely. And these are people that have millions of dollars. And look at their receipt closely, and then they argue about the bill and say, will you charge me for this? Because so much of their time and energy in their mind, their whole thought, is completely bound up mm-hmm. in money. Well, that did help them get that much money they have. But, I think Jesus said, where your heart is, there shall your treasure be. So if your heart is just in your money, well, that's your treasure, not beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Good. I wanted to go get back to you, and you said gratitude. How did you mean?
Well, I've just noticed for myself when I'm feeling full of gratitude that there isn't longing for more. So I feel an absence of greed in those moments.
So it isn't a wearing down of greed, it's more of a different flip side that produces feelings that are enriching. Mm-hmm. Robert?
My first recollection of dealing with greed was when I was about 11 years old, and the carnival would come to our school each year, and they had these horse races where you would play this pinball machine and make the horse go across the board as mm-hmm. fast as you could, and if you won, you'd win a particular size horse, first copper, and then, then the silver, then gold, and you'd keep trading up. So I got caught up in this thing, and it got to the point where I spent all my money, and then I was begging people for a dime, because it was a dime to play this game, and so I was out, you know, all day begging for dimes, and then, you know, playing and winning, and then I remember just getting home and just like getting present to what I had done to keep playing this and feeling really ashamed. So for me, it was kind of the reflection of just actually getting that my actions, that, you know, my greed overwhelmed what my normal actions would be, and it caused me to do some things I would normally never do. Beg for money, mm-hmm. And then just when I got present to that, then I stepped away from it on my own.
Hmm.
So that was my first experience with greed. Hmm.
That was a complete process that you went through too. When it's like, and then the carnival comes the next time, it's like there's just
no more.
So one time was enough in that.
Well, going through that. I played a little bit, but getting into it to that degree.
Yes, Mary?
Yeah, so as I think about greed, there is a sense of just me involved. So if I observe that, so all I'm thinking about is my own needs. So if I'm in that space, I'm only thinking about my own needs or my family needs. So there's a sense of greediness because I feel like there's a sense of scarcity that I cannot make enough and I have to hoard the money. So if I wanted to move out of that mindset, it's really to think about we, the collective. How can I be more generous? Mm-hmm. How can I come from a place of compassion? How can I circulate the money so that everybody is equal in having an experience on this earth? Mm-hmm. And I feel that when I move into that generosity or that philanthropic nature, I am able to move from greed. And greed, just to me, it becomes a scarcity piece, and there's an attachment, and there's this clinging, as you were talking about. But to loosen up the cling is the belief of there's more than enough on this planet for everybody.
Mm-hmm. There's the aspects of community and nurturing the larger element that you spoke of is there's a movement that's happening now. We talk about time is money. And we have banks that take care of our money. But there are time banks. Has anyone heard of a time bank? It's a concept that's coming into different communities now where people nurture each other and help the communities by exchange. A time exchange. And so there are these time banks that are set up in different communities now. And I suppose it could be called like a bartering system where you exchange time. And it's something that I don't know if there's interest you can charge on that or betting that it's going down or up so you can make money off of that. But it's not money related. It's time related and service related. And it isn't like a landscaper works an hour and that equals what a doctor makes. It might be that a doctor's services may be worth 20 landscapers' hours. And so I'm not sure if these time banks have they have a pool. And in various communities now, they're happening, whether it's in Georgia, there are like 400 people that have joined up in a time bank. And so you would imagine there would be quite a diversity of professions of and exchange. And it might be that there is some barter type that's there, but there'd have to be some, I don't know, it's an idea that I think we'll see more of as time goes on. But it, in a way, it's bypasses the means of exchange that money has, and it goes more directly to the person and community where you're living and working. And yes?
I think it was in the New York Times yesterday.
It was?
Online.
About time banks?
People exchanging their skills. The thing was that the skills of the landscaper were equated to the skills of the physician. There was not like 20 landscapers equals one physician type of thing, you know. All types of labor were considered equal. Otherwise, you might as well have money. I mean, you need that. You need that part of it, that you respect whatever this person can contribute. And yeah, they're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln once said, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. And I think that one of our current premises that's adhered to much.
Are you looking for a commentary on that?
Are you looking for someone to remind you that he was a Republican?
The first Republican.
I think the Republicans were more like Democrats in Lincoln's time, if I remember right.
Yeah. That was merely a party to oppose expansion of slavery, most of all free soil farmers. That was the biggest thing why that came about. And then the capital, the huge money called the Money Trust by Mark Twain, got behind and ended up controlling everything, which they do today. But I was going to say one comment was that an enlightened saint in India made a comment about this, which is that, and this is in all the scriptures in India, the more money a person has, the more illusions flow on them. And if you know the Hindu trinity, you know, Shiva, Vishnu, Brahma, Vishnu's the big illusion guy. Vishnu's the preserver, and Krishna was a Vishnu incarnation. Vishnu's the preserver. He's the guy taking, the operator. He's the guy taking care of everything right now. Brahma creates it, and when it's time for it to go, Shiva gets rid of it. So there's a way of controlling things, which is just throwing more and more illusions on people. What I get from reading everything in Buddhism is that what we're really dealing with when we're talking about, you know, like the precepts controlling our behavior, we're really dealing with struggling with these illusions, because they really are, they're temporary. It's certainly not something that's permanent. So in that way, you can call it an illusion. But even just our own desires, and we don't really, then you get it, and then you realize, well, this really wasn't what I wanted after all. Big illusions going on. So the more money, people who have a huge amount of money apparently then attract to themselves naturally, according to spiritual law, huge illusions. So they're doing all kinds of funny things with their money and whatever. And it's really not good for them and not good for everyone else since they have so much influence.
So one comment I just wanted to make is, are we saying that money's good or bad?
Well,
there's this perspective of it's bad in this
yes.
realm, and then
it's
there's
good or bad.
Yes.
Yeah, and it seems like it's perspective, and if money is just a form of energy.
Form of energy.
And so it's our it's our relationship with the money that determines our reality with money.
Right. In biology, I think water is a essential element for sustenance of life, but also organisms need a carbon source and an electron receptor. And the carbon source would be the food we consume, and the electron receptor would be the oxygen that we breathe for the oxidation-reduction reaction. And maybe it's phosphorus that's part of the Krebs cycle that's also an electron receptor in the ADP to ATP cycle that generates energy for our bodies. I wonder if money can also be determined, like you called it energy, or it could be a carbon source. Treated as a carbon source in another domain.
So we should burn it.
Eat it. It gets used. It's. I wonder what prehistoric money would look like, where you have. Yes, Cliff.
There's a recent book, and I don't remember the title of it, unfortunately, but it's called The Myths of Money. It traces, you know, capital through the ages, how different civilizations dealt with them. But the whole idea is it's totally fictional. You know, it's just our ideas. So I think your talk is about greed, not about, you know, the particular fiction that we all have in common right now.
Mm-hmm.
Called money in our minds.
But I agree with you, Mary, about that it's a neutral element, and yet there's all this burden that's put on it, and that's why I think it's useful to look at our relationship with money. How I think of most of us live week to week, or we're 2 weeks away from being homeless, and when that check hits the bank and we can go get our groceries on a Friday, just the relief that happens. And if your last week received your last unemployment check and you don't know where the next money is going to come, just the amount of anxiety that's there and how to be sustained. And it's that's where the larger community needs to be, is connected with in a lot of ways, where it's then becomes a support mechanism from families and by church organizations and others. Yes, Victor.
I was just wondering if it's possible to have a lot of money and still be a Buddhist and have, you know, be at peace. My experience, and I had money, a fair amount of money a while back, and I just got caught up in it. I know, looking back on it, I noticed I was arrogant. You know, I in the conversation with people, I'd bring up the fact that I had a nice house, or, you know, it was like I got caught up in the whole thing. Now looking at it, and I feel kind of ashamed about it. So, in one of the sutras, we talk about do not take on the burden of money. And I wonder if it's even possible for us to have a lot of money and still be practicing Buddhism. I don't know.
And I wonder just the opposite, too. Is it possible not to have money, but not the community and have that sort of anxiety, and would be a Buddhist too, especially now since we can't wander in the forest except here. I mean, there's nowhere to sleep. It's all cement and cities, and it's not, the world isn't the same as when all these wonderful monks traveled the world, and you know, you could live from the land, so it's created. So I have the same question that may be coming from that on this end.
The way I would answer that is, I would say, yes, can be Buddhist and rich or poor, because the fundamental thing of Buddhism is to ask, what is this? What is this? Moment by moment, we're asking, what is this? And when you have thousands of dollars, or $1, or $10, what is this? And what do you do with it? And how do you feel about it? And I think the fundamental question in Buddhism is, what is this? And then by examining with our, I call it evaluating and taking stock of our instrumentation. The five skandhas and our mind, I would call as our instrumentation. Whether our smell, we can smell like, I think it's something like 2 parts per million hydrogen sulfide. So it's a pretty sensitive apparatus we have. If it gets above 10 or 12 parts per million, it can be deadly and you can't smell it anymore. So we can smell subtle odors of incense, of gasoline, of the decay of a rose. We have this instrumentation that we have, and we take stock of it every day. How am I doing? Time for a shower. How hydrated are we? How hungry are we? We're checking our instrumentation all the time and relating it to this. And I think part of being a Buddhist is the repeated examination of this and our using our instrumentation. And even Helen Keller, who was deaf and blind, was able to still develop some very profound insights into this.
So what's coming up for me as I think about money has been, depending on how I feel about myself, money can be used in a way of arrogance to define how important I am. Look at what I have. I have a house. I have a car. Look at how important I am as a person. And I've had a time in my life where I stripped everything out of my life. I sold all my belongings. And I had nothing. I lived a very simple life. Yet I was confronted now with a part of me that didn't feel good enough, that money was taking residence of. And then once I was able to reconcile that and really love and deepen who I am and really appreciate that, wow, all that I'm seeking through money has been this happiness. And I found, as I have ground myself in really loving who I am as a person. Now, money doesn't have its control over me, because I thought if I wore the right clothes, or I had the right hair, if I had the right house, people would like me. So it's an interesting tool.
Mm-hmm.
That I guess you're talking about the instruments, is that how the identification that money brings into our lives and has brought into my life. And when we're detached, as the Buddha teaches, suffering is about attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, when I detached from that, the suffering or making it wrong went away, because money brought me options. When I was not having money, I had no options in that way. In the way to go out and live my Dharma, and to go out and share my gifts with people, it was limiting without sources of money. So I know I said a lot, so thank you.
I feel exactly the same way you do. And I used to live here at Jokoji, and then I spent a lot of time putting myself through the other world, where I needed not lots of money, but I needed money. And for myself, I find it really difficult to just love myself constantly. Like, I feel that there's huge cultural pressure to have money, too, that it's, and that you have to really, really be focused. That's, you know, what I discovered. And when I came back to Jokoji, when I brought my granddaughter, first thing that occurred to me after just being here a little bit and talking with people was, this is really great. There are no winners or losers.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a different environment. So I may be too permeable or too vulnerable a person, but I find that the environment, and if you live with lots of people where money is important, or to have certain things is very important, I find it's hard to not go along, you really have to love yourself to just be who you are, how you really feel amongst maybe a different set of values, even though everybody's like, they're all the same.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think that by going through these processes of having lots of money, and even being arrogant with money and using it that way, and that pretty soon the rough edges get worn down. I think the arrogance gets worn down eventually. Having no money and being grateful for having a dishwasher's job is, and finding that sufficient, is a blessing. And then to when you're set where it sounds like you are now, where you are, it's like, whether there's money, whether there's no money, here I am. I get to work on a big money project. I live here on the weekends, and then I work downtown San Francisco on the Transbay Terminal, which is a $4 billion project. That's a little money. That's where the money is. And yet, they don't have all of the $4 billion yet. They're still trying to shake the money loose. A lot of it's coming from the federal government, which means from taxpayers. It's coming from state and local funds, some properties that are associated with it. There are big, important contractors on this job that, and it's just, I feel pretty good about myself and where all this is, and it's just pretty entertaining to see some of this. And how it plays out is, it's a processing thing that happens. It's generating a lot of jobs for a lot of people that need work, and they appreciate the jobs, and it's a very diverse population that is working on this project. So it's just interesting to have a Buddhist perspective, and I'm just sort of really surprised to be on this project. That's a great opportunity, and work with a lot of interesting people. But to me, it comes down to this, our heart. And one of the things I like to do is greet people on the project. As a resident engineer, I go around and, how are you doing today? How are you doing today? And next time I see them, their hands out ready to shake my hand. How are you, Doug? How are you today? And it's like whether they're the flag lady who's stopping the traffic, this round black woman who's named Joy, and she is joy. She is pure joy. And she'll wave from half a block away, Doug! You know? And she's just that much in love with life. And others that are, it's a community. It's a community that's of happening. And so in that case, I guess money is helps to fuel it. Thank you.